Good evening. I'm very pleased to welcome here tonight Alexei Pankin, who is now editor-in-chief of the Russian European journalist review called Sreda. Props so that you can see it. The only truly independent Russian magazine. I first met Alexei in 1993, when he selected me for a media monitoring job on the basis that I was a pleasantly conservative reactionary. What I think he meant was that my views coincided with his, so we have here a pleasantly conservative reactionary. Alexei was born into the Soviet establishment. He was the son of a man of the 60s. He worked at the Institute of American and Canadian Studies of the Russian Soviet Academy of Sciences and was one of a group of intellectuals who fed Gorbachev with the ideas that became the new thinking. In 1988, he became the deputy editor of the journal International Affairs in Moscow, which rapidly became a new thinking journal. So Alexei was in on new thinking from the beginning, and he is therefore eminently well qualified for this lecture in the 1989 series. Alexei.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to be here with you. Let me start with my own reaction to the first reactions in the audience when Margot said that the Sreda, the magazine which I now edit, is the only independent magazine in Russia. There were some healthy skeptical smiles, but we are independent if only because we got foreign funding. The magazine is supported by TASS's democracy program, and it's supported from Brussels, which means basically that those people who give money don't even read Russian, so that makes us completely independent, really, even from them. Now, when I got this invitation to speak on the topic of new thinking, it made me restless, because not that often you come back to those exciting times which started as a blow of fresh air or fresh wind, and then turned into rather depressing developments. Lots of these things are still not clear to me, and I sort of come back to them and consider and reconsider, as many other people do. So I was thinking ever since July, when I got this invitation, and trying to put some kind of coherent picture of what had happened, but basically it's a probably not very well matching together pieces of a mosaic, which I will try to present to you. And I think that a couple perhaps introductory and remarks and reservations are due. First of all, if you look at things from a historical perspective, you will see that Russia is a nation with a more than 1,000-year-old history, with 1,000 years of Christianity. Only in 1863, serfdom was abolished. Before that time, the majority of the Russian population was not even free. They belonged to nobility and could be traded like goods. Before the communist revolution, Russia had only had 12 years of more or less constitutional development, that is, parliament, free press, etc. Four of these 12 years fell on the World War I, when, of course, all democratic institutions were, if not abolished, then curtailed. So then we had a horrible 70 years of communism, when, let's say, by different estimate, from 40 to 60 million people died. So when you look back at this past I don't know, 15 probably, yeah, years from 1985. It is actually amazing how smoothly things are going. From the historical perspective, I think lots of things that have happened have been inevitable, and in very many respects, all these things could be really much worse, which doesn't mean that having this historical, so Russia is on its way, and this way will be quite a long, to a mature democracy and civil society. Well, having said that, it does mean that, of course, it's very pleasant to be a participant in all these things, and that life is smooth and nice. So, in this sense, I suppose I will be speaking about lots of depressing things. Another small waiver is, okay, as a conservative reactionary, I have to explain myself a little bit. And I will explain it by an old Soviet joke. A young aspiring party functionary was once asked, well, you always agree with your bosses, but do you have an opinion of your own? And this young guy said, of course I do, but I disagree with it strongly. And that's my situation, because I think that very often I really hate lots of things that I'm saying. I hate lots of thoughts that come to my mind. I dislike quite a lot about my own people. And by that I mean really still the population of the Soviet Union, where I was born, and which I dare say know quite well. But, well, things are the way they are, and that's, and I just have to say these things which I profoundly dislike and which often found really, may sound denigratory or to my own country and to my people, which is even worse. I think that nothing is new under the sun, but it turned out, and it happened so that my position during these whole years was pretty unique for many reasons, and that's kind of some biographical notes are also due, I suppose, to give a better understanding of how I arrived at the conclusions that I arrived. First of all, I was really born into an establishment. My father was editor of the national newspaper, very popular one, Komsomolskaya Pravda. Then he became the founder of the Soviet Copyright Agency. And that means basically that he was very much a part of Russian nomenklatura and of cultural elite. I was married to a daughter of the deputy minister for shipbuilding industry, one of the most powerful men in the defense industry. And That in itself, by the way, was quite an unusual, because cultural elites and industrial elites in the Soviet Union, they normally would not mix. They would not even communicate. They despised themselves sort of from a distance. But just by virtue of this birth, or by this marriage, I simply was sort of imposed, had excellent access from the very inside to the military-industrial complex, to the cream of it. The Institute of United States and Canadian Studies, which I joined in 1971, was one of the most important and powerful think tanks in the Russian foreign policy. And I was indeed a part of a small group who were close, pretty close to the director, George Arbatov, who was an influential advisor to Brezhnev, Andropov, not to Chernenko, but to Gorbachev for a couple of years. And just by virtue of this sort of quite early access, I was very much exposed to all the inside workings of foreign policy establishment, of foreign policy making. Then when Perestroika started, of course, the Institute and Arbatov were about the first people to jump on that. And we were writing what it was called, memos to the Central Committee, basically proposing lots of new thinking ideas. I think our group, of course, it's sometimes, we certainly knew that this sort of what we do goes to Gorbachev table. Sometimes we would find sort of phrases and ideas, etc., in his speeches. Interestingly, at least from the very beginning, lots of this new thinking was coming as a response to another crazy ideas of the Communist Party hierarchy of the ideological department. And some stage, I think that was sort of at the beginning of the Gorbachev era, when the propaganda establishment was obsessed with counter-propaganda. It was assumed that the West is waging propaganda war against the Soviet Union, so we had to invent all sorts of counter-propaganda thesis. So among other things that we proposed were a release of academician Sakharov from his Gorky exile, and let's say admitting in Russia a multi-party system. So sometimes it worked in the Soviet establishment, and the ridiculous cause could lead to a very sensible result. Okay, in 1988, I became a deputy editor of Международная жизнь, which is which was the foreign policy magazine in Russia. It was very close to Shevardnadze, and I was very close to some of Shevardnadze's advisors. I was particularly appreciated, probably not so much for my new thinking ideas, of which there were some, but for my, let's say, writing talents. I was probably the only person outside of Shevardnadze's immediate speechwriter who could imitate Shevardnadze's very flowery or oriental style when you're sort of putting a very simple idea with very many words. So that was a rare talent, because they say only one person could do this. His advisor, his speechwriter, who was also a Georgian, so that was not a problem for him. But that was my sort of a lot of my contribution from this to the new thinking as exposed by Shevardnadze came from there. So in any case, there you're getting in this position. I was really part of the foreign policy establishment, so I was very much inside the foreign policy sort of thinking, planning, etc. At the same very time of perestroika, I happened also to get involved in the what was called in Russia informal activities, basically being present at the birth of a number of discussion clubs, which were then the first manifestation of any kind of civil society. I also was one of the founding father of the 20th Century and Peace magazine. That was probably the only really free thinking outlet in Russia, which did not denounce things that we didn't like, but try to discuss and explain. And so in this respect, I was sort of also accepted as I don't know, equal partner, etc., in this sort of semi-dissident, semi-democratic, whatever community. And also I discovered very sort of early in my life that Moscow is not Russia, and I traveled quite a lot in Russia and did lots of things in the regions. So in this sense, I'm really very uniquely positioned, because, as I say, many of the texts that were then deemed a historical one way or another, where I either contributed to some of them or saw them before publication, and I could only judge not only by texts, but also by the people's motives and their personalities, etc., which is an important part of any kind of thinking. So that would end perhaps the... And so basically what I'm going to present is probably might look as a collection of anecdotes, but it just happens. That's the way I perceive the situation. So now coming to the new thinking. I think in this phrase, new thinking, of course, thinking is very important, is the most important part. And the problem was that to have a proper thinking, new, old, I don't know, future, whatever, you need to know the subject you are thinking about. And that was perhaps the fundamental problem in all the reforms of the Soviet Union, that we lived in a society which completely did not know, did not explore, did not understand itself. And I think, interestingly, again, the first person who openly confessed that was Yuri Andropov, after he was moved from being head of the KGB for many years, after he became number two man in the party establishment, the secretary of the Communist Party for Ideology. He wrote a very interesting piece in a communist magazine, the theoretical organ of the Communist Party, in which he had openly confessed that we do not know the society we're living in. And that was, of course, that was far, well before the perestroika started, but it was an amazing confession from somebody who had all this, what it's called, secret institutions, which were supposed to have studied the country, had, I don't know, hundreds perhaps of thousands of what we would call plain clothes sociologists, that is, secret informers in every cell of society. So basically, he confessed that we do not know the society we're living in. And there are quite a number of reasons for that. One of them is, of course, that the communist ideology, as it was perceived in Russia, was completely dogmatic. All findings should, one way or another, should have conformed to the scripture. I mean, the only good thing is that the scripture, both all three guys, Marx, Engels, and Lenin, during their lifetimes wrote volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes. So you would find there a confirmation for, and they often contradicted each other, so you would find in their text something to refer to confirm your most sort of wildest thoughts. As a side note, basically all people who would be dissidents, they started with secretly reading Lenin and making sort of notes, because again, if you read Lenin, like we all did, especially not those texts that were recommended for reading, but others, you would find a scathing criticism of the Soviet system, of bureaucracy, etc. So most dissidents, as I keep saying, which is again funny, found an inspiration for their dissent in the readings of Lenin. So one thing is that, again, coming back to the main course, one thing is that there was the society simply did not study itself. Either there was no way to do that because of dogmatism, and there were also no instruments, because for many years, for decades, in fact, sociology was kind of a forbidden science, a bourgeois science, a pseudo-science, etc. There were some excellent, by the way, sociologists and people who would have this, but there were very few of them. And while, let's say, they sometimes did research, and good research, but very few of that would filter outside some very narrow circles. The same would go for journalism. There was lots of really investigative journalism and good journalists, but again, they would sort of analyze and criticize really isolated events and facts, etc. And so you would never get a full picture of the situation. Then another thing is that, of course, this overriding secrecy. And that was probably the worst thing, because even people who were supposed to know how things work, they didn't, because you would know just very small sector of where you work. For instance, let's say my father and my father-in-law were very exposed to quite a lot of things, but they would hardly know. Well, again, just to put it mildly, my father, as editor of a national daily, he had no idea and had no way to find out how my father's-in-law ministry worked, etc. So basically, there was no even a single reservoir of knowledge, and not a single person who could say who knows how the Soviet economy, ideology, I don't know, social life is organized. The only thing that literature in those times played the role of both, I don't know, social science and politics, etc. There was an amazing pluralism, by the way, in the later years of pre-Gorbachev communism, where you would find lots of the whole spectrum, actually, from ultra nationalist to liberal, etc. And all this was in the official sort of permitted open literature in these literary magazines, etc. Literature is, I mean, at best, if you read it as a research instrument, you would only get a glimpse of how people could potentially react to this or that situation. For instance, if you read Shukshin, that will give you a very good idea of Russian people, of what their interests, how they live, etc., etc. But this can hardly be an instrument of really promoting any kind of coherent or supporting coherent reform. So basically, and of course another thing is that most of the people who were like new thinkers like myself, they very often were like many Russian sort of dreamy idealists, and they operated more on ideals and on what they want to see than on what actually existed. And that's why it is, in a sense, it is now pretty difficult to call new thinking a thinking at all, because thinking was separately, and what the thinking was about was completely separately. And just to give you an illustration, you remember that one of, and that's why, and lots of things that went wrong really came from this diversion between thinking and the subject of thinking. And just one example that you, to illustrate, you all remember the historical initiative of Gorbachev, the unilateral reductions of the Soviet army by 500,000 people. That was, I think, in his speech at the UN in 1987, a really important step and an important breakthrough. But when you look at it in from practical terms, that would be the consequences. First of all, 500,000 people were released. Okay, let's say 300,000 of them or 400,000 of them would be simply conscripts who would not be drafted. But 100,000 people were officers. These people had nothing, they knew nothing but their military profession. They were usually living in state, in garrisons, etc. In other words, if we take 100,000 people, that means 400,000 people had to be relocated. There was no market of so for them, through centralized planning, for them, let's say 100,000 new flats had to be built. That's one problem. Secondly, the implementation of it was a very nice initiative, but the implementation of it was given to the military establishment itself. And that meant that those who were implementing this decision, mainly pretty conservative and dumb people, they got a whip against just about everything in the army which they didn't like. It doesn't mean that only, let's say, I don't know, reformers or everyone, basically everyone who was not convenient to his immediate boss, would be immediately find himself under the threat of being sacked from the army. And this, in its turn, had really stifled a debate on the military reform inside the Soviet army itself. Because the argument, and I mean, I knew lots of people and supported them, we printed lots of their stuff in both in Международная жизнь and in this 20th Century and Peace magazine. So when they would lay out a set of arguments, the reaction of their bosses will be either to threaten them with sacking under this general reduction of armed forces, or actually sacking them. Then again, in practical terms, how this reduction was done. This too was left for the Soviet military establishment, and they were cutting troops and funding, respectively, evenly. In other words, Marshal Yazov, who was at that time defense ministry, would say, okay, we will cut out one tank regiment and one space troops regiment. Again, what would this mean? This would mean that a tank regiment, well, what was a tank regiment? I mean, nobody in the Soviet Union could actually count how many tanks we had. But I suspect that they didn't even know, couldn't count the number of tank regiments too. So basically one more, one less wouldn't mean anything. What is a regiment, or the equivalent of the regiment in the space forces? This is a observation point which is basically tracking the satellites, and military operated probably 90% of satellites in Russia. So basically there you would lose a closing down, or reducing a regiment will mean closing down a this observation point, which would again mean that the sector of a trajectory, right, of a satellite would simply not be observed by the things. And that was, of course, a waste of resources and a threat to undermining of national security, because these kind of things are really important. Even as a pacifist, I would say I recognize that that tracking is observation is warning stuff is very important. That's how it works. So basically, a good decision not being thought through would lead to really ruinous consequences in many respects, economically, I don't know, in terms of morale-wise, it will antagonize officers, etc., etc., etc. And that, and unfortunately, wherever you look, you would find some kind of a situation like that, where good intentions would lead to disastrous consequences because people simply did not really understand how the country works. And no single person, well, actually, in my sort of endless explorations of various strata of society, I found only one person with a clear and very coherent picture of how the Soviet society works. The problem is that he was a sort of recent, when I met him, he had just retired from the main intelligence directorate of the general of the Soviet Army General Staff. He was on one of the analytical institute. He happened by virtue of his work, he really was exposed both to the best you can have in the about Western economy and military planning, etc., and to the fullest you can have about the Soviet economy and military planning. The problem with him was that he was under so many security pledges that there was absolutely no way he could share this, his knowledge and understanding with with anyone around. And although, as I say, I haven't met anyone else with such a profound knowledge and such a coherent and clear and clearly acceptable to the people nature ideas of how to reform Russia. That's probably the most important thing, that thinking, whatever and however nicely it may have sounded to the foreigners, was completely irrelevant and even destabilizing when it was applied on the domestic situation. Now, another thing, why new thinking was both important and detrimental is the fact that it was very much Western-oriented and borrowed from from the West. And that was another very important cultural development still under communism, that quite a large part of population came of age who really were sort of what somebody called unwhipped generation. Is it understandable? Непоротое поколение. Yeah, unwhipped, mm-hmm. Unwhipped generation. Other people who had never lived under Stalin, who were born under Khrushchev, but had easily forgotten all this chaos and constant sort of chaotic reforming of Khrushchev, and had lived out under a very sort of a really stable period when the exposure to everything Western was very much expanding gradually. And so they really had no fears, neither fears nor dogmas of their fathers and grandfathers. And they learned lots, and they were Western oriented. And today, just again, to give one illustration, is we Mary Calder and I, we remembered, recalled a friend or somebody we know together, Andrei Melville, who spoke at the END Perugia convention. And Mary said that how he was, it was in 83, you said, again, well before the perestroika. And Mary said how everybody attacked him and criticized him there, sort of calling him something like probably a party propagandist, etc., etc. And the fact was that since I worked for a while under him, he was one of those, you know, forces of good, who, while not being able to speak his mind openly, he in this behind the scene battles, he was contributing lots of ideas and to battle, I mean, domestically, this new Cold War, which started under Reagan, and he felt himself, and he was a kind of a, I don't know, closet liberal or a reformer, and these kind of things was pretty important during the Soviet years. Yet having this self-perception, of course he was grossly offended by being called a party propagandist, etc., which he wasn't. So basically in great part the motivation of those who were coming up with a new thinking was to finally lift the appraisal of themselves by the Westerners to the level of their self-appraisal. And that's why, if I expressed it correctly, right? And that's why, and besides, since all ideas relating to nuclear disarmament and security, etc., were coming from the West, a large part of the new thinking basically is a simply sort of copying of books and articles by Mary Calder, E.P. Thompson, George Kennan, etc. So basically, there would be a greater motivation for them to look nice to the Westerners and to speak to the Westerners than to explain things to their own compatriots. And the same was in large part a motivation for this successes on the foreign policy arena of Gorbachev. They really, even those, let's say, reform-oriented people in the Communist Party establishment, they had no idea what to do with the economy, but they needed to deliver something, so they would go there where some kind of results could be achieved, could be portrayed to the people. And eventually they would have become almost totally, like Gorbachev became almost totally dependent for his survival on the support from the West. And that's fine, because if you look at very sort of in numerical terms, that brought about really very spectacular results on what seemed important at that time, like nuclear disarmament and MBFR treaty and I don't know, whatever else. The only thing is that there was absolutely no way this could be explained to the Soviet public. There was neither a language to do this, because the Russian language in the communist times have not really developed a proper terminology of its own. Nor there was a witch, by the way, because when you would see that Gorbachev was much, and many other people too, were traveling to the West and speaking to the Western audiences with more, were more pleased to speak to the foreigners than to their own people, had a very different mindset and could not simply understand them and could not relate to them. And that's why one of the things, I call this one of these maxims that I came up with, was that the desire to be liked by foreigners was one of the main reasons and tragedies of perestroika and the new thinking. Where else, what else is good about? Then, let's say, some other sources of the new thinking that are worthy of mentioning. Perestroika and glasnost is a very sort of paradoxical event, because they really shouldn't have happened. In a sense that there was really very little self-interest in changing anything in Russia when Gorbachev came to power. What do I mean? First of all, of course, when there was what was actually the most driving, sort of strongest probably driving force for change was, was boredom. Everybody was sick and tired of Brezhnev. 16 years of Brezhnev, person who could hardly speak, show, 24 times a day on national and regional television. Then general secretaries, also old and ailing people elected and then sort of dying one after another. Also in this brief tenure, being promoted to the geniuses and etc. So there was a really general sense of boredom and kind of a feeling that the change is necessary on this very abstract level. But if you look at the self-interest, then you would find that there was very little of that. First of all, if you look at the Soviet population, people had enjoyed in the 70 years of communism, the last pre-perestroika 10 or 15 years were a period of relative calm, predictability, and gradual raising of living standards. I mean, if you have that for a Russian starting point, what the measuring yardstick would be, let's say, either famine of 1928 or early 30s, and the sufferings of the war. Compared to this, most people lived much better and saw that the standards were gradually increasing. So there was absolutely no pressure from below on the reformers, let's say. Sometimes a very undue credit is given to Reagan with his new Cold War and his strategic defense initiative as somebody that compelled Russia to think, to try to see that they have to compete, which is, I mean, nothing could be further from truth, as old communist propagandists would say. Basically, why am I saying so? That again, in the détente period was also a situation of also saw a lot of domestic relaxation. There were much more things where the country was liberalizing, gradually and slowly, but still, as a person, who started contributing articles, probably from, early 70s, I could, just by myself, I could sense that you can sort of put in more and more controversial ideas every year. So whatever reasons for this new Cold War, whether it was Soviet behavior or American behavior. Nevertheless, this Cold War as portrayed this new Cold War as depicted by, as presented by Reagan and by the Soviet propaganda was a good excuse for this reactionary, I mean, not in our sense with Margot, but in a true sense of the world of the communist reaction establishment to clamp down on all these freedoms. SDI was in fact a god sent, a gift, I don't know, something that had unexpectedly fallen from the skies, a gift for the Soviet military establishment. Because in the military establishment, there were two lobbies dominating, a tank lobby and nuclear missiles lobby. And if you remember, the first Soviet reaction to the SDI was this idea of asymmetrical response or retaliation. Basically, what does it mean, asymmetrical retaliation? That you build more missiles. And that means new funding for all these, you know, factories and design bureaus, whatever, to all these people who were in charge of this sector of the Russian establishment. And tank lobby, I mean, they would benefit from anything. Whatever happens, Russian generals would say, or Soviet generals would say, we need more tanks. So this new reaction to this. So in any case, I mean, people lots of people were really happy with Reagan and SDI, and these people were quite influential within the Soviet society. Then another thing, and there was a kind of a vague feeling, which is also quite sort of often graphically described both in Russian and in Soviet literature, that the Soviet Union was trailing behind, lagging behind economically, the productivity was rising, etc. And that was true. And lots of people, decision makers, were really concerned with that on a level of kind of a general perception. But when it comes to, since you know that the communist, the centralized economy is basically economy which is a fight between lobbying groups. So when it actually come to, I don't know, creating budget, setting up priorities, etc., all would not sort of think in general terms of promoting country's economy, reforming it. Everybody thought about grabbing a piece, a chunk for himself. So inside this, there was also, even given this understanding of lagging behind, inside the system there was absolutely no stimulus even to reform itself. So to a large extent, really perestroika happened for really no obvious, no clear, and new thinking, of course, no clear reason, out of boredom and out of, as I said, desire to be liked by the West. Why did it succeed, in a sense? And I'm saying just in one sense. Why? Why wasn't, I suppose that by 1987 or 88, many people in this conservative and reactionary establishment, they began to understand that really things are going out of hand. At that time, they were still strong enough. There was very sort of insignificant democratic movements, and the free press, the press was, let's say, freer than before, but still under a lot of control. Why didn't this establishment stop the development, which they could very easily stop, given all the forces that they basically controlled the country outside of probably a dozen media outlets, etc.? And that's another paradox. And let me tell you a story coming from, again, from my personal experience. You may recall that, or those of you who studied this perestroika, let's say, month by month, that I think in the summer of 91, or early summer it was, or late spring, Pravda carried a long letter signed by several dozen of chief designers, that is, top people in this of firms in the military industrial complex, which were sort of a strong, looked like a strong warning to Gorbachev and to the people of Congress, to the Congress of People's Deputies, etc., to reconsider their policies, etc. And that was very largely interpreted by the press as another sign of this conservative anti-democracy, anti-market forces on the assault, another sign that Gorbachev is surrendering to this anti-democratic forces, which was for me very funny because I happened to have a language edited this ultimatum, so-called, one of the guys who was in fact, and I knew the true story. And the true story was also that the original letter was submitted, hand given to Gorbachev. It was signed by 9 ministers of the industrial defense complex, what's called military industrial complex, and hand sort of submitted to Gorbachev. And I knew the whole story. And the story was that one of the initiators of this kind of things, he liked me for some reason, sometimes consulted with me. So he showed me the original paper, and I did some sort of put some commas in the proper places. I still have a carbon copy of this pre-edited document. And I said to him then, okay, well, that's fine, but you must understand that this is really an ultimatum. And now, after this, you either have to push it through to the end, or Gorbachev will sack you all. He will understand what it means. That's politics. And so this is what you must realize. And so we spoke with him several days later, and I said how it worked. Well, he said, oh, fine, it was given to Gorbachev. I said, how? He said, well, one of our ministers hang around for a couple of days in the Gorbachev reception. Gorbachev had no time to receive him. Then he caught him sort of almost literally on his way to the toilet over there, handed it to him. Gorbachev looked through that and said, okay, that's very interesting, but I have no time to discuss these things now. I will call you, or we will arrange it for a special meeting, etc. And I said, well, I don't think it's a proper way, I said to him, it's a proper way to deal with the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the President of the Soviet Union. Once you 9 people who really control the Soviet economy, once you agreed between yourself, don't sort of spend about, I don't know, 10 minutes, go to the General Staff Headquarters, call Gorbachev from the office of Chief of General Staff and say, well, Comrade President, you know, there are 9 ministers of defense industry and chief of general staff having sort of assembled together in his office. We would like to meet you, to talk with you in 20 minutes. And I said, you will see, he will be there in 10 minutes. And I mean, you should have seen this guy. In fact, he paled in his face, and he began excusing himself and apologizing and saying, no. This had never occurred to me. We are just sort of plain, I don't know, industrialist, loyal people to our president. We're only drawing attention to the president to some problems in the Soviet economy, but whatever they decide is whatever he decides will be correct, we will accept this. And he clearly took me for a provocateur, kicked me out of the office, and so that was end of our confidential relations. And the fact is, then it occurred to me that in fact Perestroika in this sense was really saved and or rescued by the legacy of Stalinism, because Comrade Stalin was sort of destroying layer after layer, industrial managers, I don't know, military, whatever, just generation after generation were completely replaced. And in the hands of these people, on the level of genetic memory, it stuck that they should not be involved in politics under no conditions. They did not even think politically. And even those who had sort of survived, who came of this age much later, after Stalinism, still it was kind of the collective industrial or whatever memory. And that's why they were really, as I said, the people who controlled all the country for the sole purpose of the sacred status of the General Secretary and this collective memory of the past purges, that's why they had allowed to do with them whatever happened to them. So that's another paradox of Russian reforms. So basically, this I call the communism was not defeated; it committed suicide. Now let's go back to the Western role. I think that in very many respects, the West in their interaction with Gorbachev was also like the Soviets. It really had no understanding of the way the system worked. I think that the whatever faults are there in the West and in the Western thinking, there's still this cause-result mentality, sort of logical mentality. In other words, if something happens, it happens for a certain cause, and which is true, but the cause may have been very different than perceived. Basically, they thought that if something happens, I mean, somebody wants to achieve something. And that was true, but as I said, the logic was completely absurd very often. I mean, the most convincing argument I heard, or explanation for the Russian invasion in Afghanistan, was that they wanted to create a big noise and the pretext to get rid of academician Sakharov and to send him over to Siberia. And I find this argument perhaps as, oh, not to Siberia, to Gorky, sorry. And I find this argument about as credible as estimations of a new round of Soviet expansion and drive to the warm seas, etc. The whole thing about, for instance, what is called mid-range nuclear missiles stationed in Europe in sort of improbable quantities was, of course, interpreted in the West as some kind of Russian new drive, new aggressiveness, etc. In fact, I suppose the reason was that the head of this design bureau that designed this weapon had good access to Brezhnev, probably. They probably were drinking together sometimes. And so he managed to convince Brezhnev that they to give him money to build as many of those missiles as possible. So in the West that was interpreted very differently. So I think that in very many respects, in all this situation, the West has reacted to not really to this internal dynamics of Russian developments and to what it really meant, but to the perception. And from here, lots of mistakes were committed. Basically, I think that there were two major mistakes. One of them is that there was a lot of, that too much emphasis was given to supporting of Gorbachev. He seemed to have been the only person to have the West was sort of willing to talk to, and since at some point Gorbachev became really the most hated person in the Soviet Union, the West had really, by supporting him, but by sticking to him so unquestionably, they were really reinforcing his position and destabilizing the situation in the Soviet Union. On the other hand, the way they supported Gorbachev was also quite mistaken, because I think they completely neglected such important developments in the Soviet Union as the sovereignization and drive for reestablishment of the national republics. And I think the problem was that the West at some point became kind of a top supreme referee of Russian developments. And the pretty moderate, even nationalistic leaders, they were appealing to the West. The West did not listen to them. And they began shouting louder and louder and louder and louder, getting sort of radicalized very often beyond what they were really prepared to do, and just to catch the eye of the Western leaders. And for them, shouting louder, of course, was going after Gorbachev. So, in a sense, by speaking only to Gorbachev, lots of the Western policies have largely undermined Gorbachev as a really most skillful, I don't know, balancer between various things. Well, I'm only halfway through to what I was going to say, and I suppose the time is running out. So let's consider that I put, let's say, one third of this mosaic, and perhaps I shall leave some time for questions.
You can come and sit down and answer the questions. Alexei, thank you very much for your talk. The least deterministic interpretation of 1989, I think, that we have had. We have some time, so Alexei would be happy to answer questions. There are some portable microphones, and the acoustics in this room are very poor. So after I recognized you, could you please wait for the microphone? And could you also please say who you are before you ask your question? It's the gentleman over there.
Donald Davidson, you said that there's no internal pressure for perestroika and glasnost. I mean, I fully understand that there's no reason at all why the Soviet establishment should engage in a policy of glasnost. I found that rather curious. But I mean, I know all I'm saying is that from what I've read, is that there was an economic, well, some form of economic crisis, which there was internal pressure for perestroika, because the perception amongst the people just below the top, like the people of General Gorbachev's generation, that the opinion formers, that there was a growing economic crisis which has to be resolved in some way. I mean, I've heard of the Novosibirsk statement of 1983 to Tanya Zaslavskaya, mm-hmm. which is an example of this feeling that something has to change in the Soviet economic system.
Yeah, I agree with you basically, but this does not contradict what I said, because yeah, there was a perception that there has to be a change. Sometimes it was substantiated by facts, figures, research, etc. But there was absolutely no internal motivation for this change, because one thing is that what you think, but when it sort of these really important decision makers, when they come to dividing their chunk of this budget cake and investment, etc., they would behave completely differently. There was very little mean. The Soviet Union was a, I would say that for this party establishment or whatever, even the, but for different reasons than now, but even then, the idea of some kind of national interest or common good or even sort of affinity to the country was almost non-existent. The people were more concerned about their staying in power than about anything else. So even if, as I say, there was a feeling that there has to be a change, there was a perception of that the economy was, degrading, that we're lagging behind, etc. But in the system, there was really no mechanism for translating this into some kind of reform.
Thank you. Sergei Stanishev, may I ask you two questions? The first is considering your words that you didn't understand the Soviet society at the beginning of the 80s. Do you think that now, well, Russian scientists and political analysts understand what really happens in Russia. I mean, can you analyze the decisions which have been taken, why they have been taken, etc.? Because we witnessed a number of decisions which surprised not only the West, for example, as during the course of a crisis, the appearance of Russian forces, but I think the Russian foreign minister as well. And the other question is about the Russian perceptions of the results of the new thinking for Russia in the world. Because there is a very widespread, I think, opinion in Russia that, in fact, the new thinking was simply used by the West in order to disintegrate the Soviet Empire. So in this relation, how do you evaluate the results of the new thinking policy in foreign sphere? And how do you think which direction Russian foreign policy will take after Yeltsin? Thank you.
Okay, do we understand our society better than before? I think yes. In general, yes. First of all, really, those are a little bit different levels of analysis, because one way is to understand how the society functions and organized in general. And I think for this, we are much better equipped for many reasons now. And another thing is to analyze any sort of individual decision, why things happen in this way or in that way. In this sense, very often, and especially now, I think, as one person says, that events defy any normal prognostic calculations, that no normal means of prognosis can be applied to analyzing the decisions of our immediate policymakers. Then how do I assess the results of the new thinking? I think I sort of try to by this my introductory remark, which could be summed up in two words. It could be worse. I mean, these things could hardly be ever smooth. And I say, when the society is built on 60 million killed people, normally under sort of normal conditions, you would at least expect at least half as much to be laid in its undoing. And basically, the greatest losses were 100,000 people killed in Chechnya in the first war, and that was sort of post Gorbachev in the New Russia period. So, if you take a detached view, a sociologist, that if you do not live in this country but sort of look at it from the outside, I think it could be much worse. It really could be much worse, because among this, even when I describe this sort of the suicide of communism, right? Nevertheless, among these people, there was a chance that a real leader, a decisive person, will emerge among them. Somebody like Lebedev, for instance. And these people had really no scruples. I mean, all this, they could kill as much to stop this. If you look at the August coup, for instance, I mean, there were so many chances for so many corpses. So in this sense, it's really, it could be worse. Yeah. And as far as the Soviet, the Russian foreign policy, again, Russia is kind of even more than the Soviet Union. Very few people still identify themselves with Russia. So even the idea of a national interest is somewhat, probably far fetched. So I think, and I suspect that these two will be pretty much personal decisions rather than promoting somebody's interests or whatever. Although I think that if you speak about the foreign policy again on a sort of rather high level of abstraction, I think one important thing did happen. The pre-Primakov and pre-crisis foreign policy of Russia was basically promoting the export-oriented industries. And now it's more like domestic producer-oriented. It's like very much like, you know, the American Civil War, where South and North had very different perceptions of what their foreign policy should be, depending on whether they lived on cheap slave labor and were interested in importing goods, or were they industrialized and were interested in barring exports. So that was one, more or less, I would say, major change, which is primarily due to this crisis of August 17 last year.
Jim Kennedy. Among the various sources of the new thinking, you mentioned that most interestingly the fact that some dissidents were finding inspiration in their reading of Lenin.
Mm-hmm.
And also you mentioned books by Mary Kaldor, George Kennan, and others. I wonder to what extent you ascribe importance to the underground circulation of manuscripts and other unpublished materials as a contributing, as a source of the new thinking.
Well, I suppose, yeah, I hardly know anyone who among educated Russians who would not have access to some of that. That's what you mean, I suppose. Yeah, and I think that this did contribute to this sense that the change is necessary, right? In a way, it was very educational. And then another thing is that, I don't know, many of the liberal reformers, establishment reformers of the communist era, will too be exposed to this type of literature, and that was kind of source of inspiration for them to work sort of this inside the establishment. So I would say that Samizdat played a pretty important role in promoting this vague and illogical drive for change.
Very often the thaw in the Cold War from 1986 to about 1989 with the Soviet Union's relations with the West are characterized as being as a means of reforming within. Gorbachev had to have a benign international environment, so it was to set the context in which reform within could occur. This to me seems to sit a little, this characterization seems to sit a little uneasily with your somewhat haphazard description of the new thinking and the development of new thinking. Is this characterization accurate, do you think?
Could you make this characterization again?
In which the thaw with the West during 86 to 89 was pursued as a means to allow, to pursue a benign international environment so as to be able to pursue domestic reform. So to end the Cold War so that you could reform inside.
Well, again, as I said, that was important. The thing is that, of course, lots of things, lots of reforms which have happened, they have been really inspired by the West. Ideas were coming from the West, etc. So in what has actually happened, the Western role is very important. The only question is whether the things that have happened really were what the Soviet Union had needed, and whether this contributed to the least, let's say, whether this was the best option. That's the thing. There's the role of the West in Russian reforms in very many respects, from ideas to, I don't know, to funding, to support of the people, etc., to political role, is very important. The other thing is how, let's say, whether it was the promoting the type of reform which could be most, let's say, peaceful and I don't know, smooth. That's a different question. Basically, this person actually, who I said was the only person who to understand how the economy, Russian economy and Western economy works. One of his ideas was again to come to the same result, that is, economic reform and democracy, by completely different rationale. What he was saying is that it is necessary to say to the Russian people that what is happening now is that the West, NATO, United States are dangerous, aggressive powers who are really preparing for the war, while the Soviet Union had been betrayed by their generals, that the way the Soviet army was, built with all this, I don't know, hundreds of dozens of thousands of tanks, with all these meaningless military expenditures, etc., that's a real devastation of the economy, that the Russia is sitting almost powerless, sort of defenseless, in front of a dangerous enemy. And the way to combat, to counter this threat, would be to very quick unilateral disarmament, because we simply do not need what we have for defense or security. Quick and radical market reform, because that's the only economic foundation for a normal and healthy and really reliable defense, and quiet and non-aggressive foreign policy, so as not to provoke this rival into a real aggression against Russia. And this argument would certainly be bought by the Russian population. Russians with their sort of siege mentality, with very bad memories of the World War I, would rather buy an argument that that you need to, that's the way to defend ourselves from a hostile world, than an argument that, okay, we have so much of weapons that we can afford to reduce. That's the thing. And we actually filtered these ideas. I had, and some people we worked with, we had enough opportunities to see through that this kind of logic would or this, some kind of hints or ideas would hit the tables of Shevardnadze and Gorbachev, and there was no reaction from them, because they were really, at that time, they were completely dependent on the support from the West. For them, suddenly, from, let's say, reformers who please the West, to turn down into reformers who use language which would be acceptable for the Russians was completely unacceptable.
Margot Picken, I wonder if you could say something about the impact of Sakharov on the new thinking, and whether he was feared because of his influence at home or because of his influence abroad.
I think, yes, Sakharov was kind of a single symbol, and I think that his impact was primarily moral. While he was there were certain things that people were ashamed to do. That's it. He was like that. I don't think that intellectually, I can't recall of any sort of contribution he made, really. So yeah, symbolically, that's a very another very interesting situation, that all these establishment reformers who really, I think, who did much more for dismantling the system than dissidents, they all had this profound sense of shame that some people who feel like themselves, but still they have courage to speak out openly and go to jail, and others are with the same perceptions of things. They do not speak out, they work behind the lines, and the system sort of rewards them, because it was again a very complex system. So lots of these establishment reformers had this, I would say, a complex for not being in jail. And that's a very important, by the way, was one of the very important driving forces in behind a lot of actions.
And now I'm going to take three questions together, and I think that we will ask Alexei to answer them, as it were, in a composite answer, because there's a reception upstairs in the senior common room, and I'm sure that his informal answers will be very good indeed. So there's one there. Four. Two down there. And one up there. First the back.
My name is Esther Weizsäcker. My questions maybe are not so much related to his speech, but nevertheless, I ask them. Is it true that the mass media today, almost without exception, is doing propaganda for the war in Chechnya? And if it is true, why is it so, and what can be done against it?
Monty.
How do you assess? How do you assess personally the role of Gorbachev in initiating, if he was the initiator, on his own or how far with other people, of glasnost and perestroika? And how far do you think that he had ideas as to where he was going, or how far do you think that he was in fact playing things by ear? And finally, what social forces in the Soviet Union do you think that he represented?
Right, there's a question up there, and then I'll come back to you.
During Primakov's time as foreign minister, and especially post-Kosovo, there has been an increasing incidence of an expression of interest on the part of Russia to look east. By that I mean the formation of a strategic relationship between Russia, China, and India. Do you see Russia going down this route, or do you see Russia going along the Western route?
Oliver Geer, up to now, you have talked about the threat to Russia coming always from the outside. But isn't it true that in a time of increasing detachment within the new Commonwealth, that the internal drifting away of the republics could pose a greater threat to Russia? And how does the Russian public or the Russian society react towards that, or would react towards a greater drifting away?
And last but definitely not least, Mary.
You put a lot of emphasis on the influence of the West on new thinking and perestroika, but I wanted to ask you about two other possible influences. One is the war in Afghanistan. How did that affect Soviet society? How did it affect young men who returned?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole attitude to conscription and being sent to places like Eastern Europe and Afghanistan. And the second is Central Europe. I mean, how did solidarity, the changes in Poland, surely that must have had quite a shaking up influence on thinking in establishment circles. I mean, I certainly remember visiting, I've now forgotten its name, that Institute for the Study of the Socialist World Economy.
Mm-hmm.
And there was as much discussion going on there as in your institute. So how do you think the East Europeans influenced new thinking?
Right, mm-hmm. And 6 minutes to answer.
Okay, one by one. Well, Chechen War is a very complex subject. Yes, the media is, let's say, reporting this story from the Russian side of the barricades. There are many reasons for that, simply again, it's a really very complex thing. Gorbachev, I think that basically Gorbachev had won perestroika and almost single-handedly. I think he was the only person who, he was kind of, I would say that the, basically, I mean, as a person, as an individual, all he was concerned with was probably his own political survival and prolongation of his political life. Yet somehow the roads or the ways he chose to political survival, somehow, as if by, I don't know, God's grace, almost coincided with the most peaceful dismantling of the system. He really, I must say that he really dismantled the system almost single-handedly. Lukist, I don't pay much attention to what our leaders are saying any longer, whether they look east or west or whatever, because why bother when governments are changing, I don't know, every 3 months? And if they say something, I mean, who cares? There will be another foreign minister, another government. And I simply stopped following Soviet policy thinking, Russian policy thinking, really. Coming, what else? Okay, outside, threat. It's a threat and outside. Well, I never said that the threat was coming from outside. Basically, it happened. I mean, there was problem really is that the Soviet society at that time, as it shaped under communism, became a threat to itself. That was the real security threat. That's what where people should have actually looked into real processes going on. In other words, that was by far more important than whatever was perceived probably as a threat from the outside. The West, I suppose the war in Afghanistan. It's all these things are require very lengthy discussion. The war in Afghanistan was something that, I mean, I guess nobody understood why it happened. There was really no, there was some kind of official reason presented for that, etc. There were lots of Western interpretations for that too, which were of course quite different, but nobody knew why it happened really. It was a drain on resources, a large drain on resources of course, and also it was really so unpopular that a leader like Gorbachev, a new one, who still had with all his nice words and all this new thinking, if he had to deliver, I had to deliver from time to time. And that was one of the things that really he did deliver, which were quite one of really few popular actions by Gorbachev. As far as what happened to these people, it's very different. I honestly didn't see any, there must be, but I never see any sort of polling of these people and what happened to them who fought in Afghanistan. As far as conscription, I suppose that it's the internal conditions in the Russian army now, and primarily, at least in the Soviet times, now there are lots of things are different, but I think it was primarily the internal conditions of conscripts in the army. Primarily, what's the English word for bullying? And then, is it bullying? These kind of things that is the actual widespread, let's say, instances when those who are in their second year of service would humiliate, almost torture younger soldiers. That has created this general unpopularity of the army. So it's not that people do not want to serve in a, let's say, conscripted army. They just, to the extent they can, they would avoid any kind of other system, be it a military cadre or whatever. Central Europe, I think that Poland too was important. Mm-hmm. Not again, not in terms of ideas, but it would add to this general perception that things are wrong. That's true. But Poland was certainly important. Poles have been always respected by the Russians for a strange reason. I mean, the Russians had always respected the Poles more than they respected Czechs, because they got away very easily, I mean, Russians, with an invasion to Czechoslovakia,
because the Czechs did not fight, there was always a perception that Poles will fight. And that's why somehow Poles were respected, and again, there are different things, very conflicting information, but my feeling is that, again, this may be completely wrong, I don't know, that invasion to Poland was not really, never considered really seriously. But I may be wrong, this I don't know.
Right, Alexei, thank you very much, and thank you for fielding so very many questions. And can I repeat that there's a reception in the senior common room, and you're all welcome on the fifth floor.